So first of all, why do we care about new light states beyond the Standard Model? So for me, the main motivating factor is that they appear very naturally in UV completions of the Standard Model, and also they have nice IR pheno and interesting effects. So in particular, they can solve problems with the Standard Model. The prime example of this is the QCD axion. They can also make good dark matter candidates, and this is particularly well motivated these days that WIMPs are not looking quite so compelling. And if you want to have some richer hidden sector, they can act as interesting portal operators and can also lead to things like self-interactions if you're concerned about the predictions of cold dark matter on small scales. Only in the context of a SUSY model. Just in the sense that you start having to play awkward games with co-annihilations if you want to link them with supersymmetry. Of course, you could just have WIMPs by themselves, but the connection to the weak scale is somewhat decreasing. Of course, you can have perfectly viable WIMP candidates still and for the future. Furthermore, light new physics is well motivated by string theory UV completions. Of course, there's a huge amount we don't know about string theory and what typical compactifications will look like, but at least based on what we know about heterotic models or 2B models, it seems like many times when you get the Standard Model out as an effective field theory, new light stuff, new hidden sectors come along with this. And finally, there are some mildly interesting anomalies that maybe new light physics could help explain, but I wouldn't put too much weight on that. So that's the physics motivation, and then the motivation for working for it is on working on this stuff is strengthened by the fact that it's relatively underexplored. So compared to, for example, LHC physics or TV scale physics, there's the potential for a large improvement in the experimental constraints or searches in the immediate future. And there's also important theoretical work to be done and more calculations to be done to improve our understanding. On the other hand, it's fair to say there's no sharp prediction for where we should expect to find new light physics. It's not like the LHC where the TeV scale is clearly an important question for naturalness and our understanding of this. But that said, there are plausible ranges. Okay, so why should we do precision theory of these new light states? Why not just search everywhere and see what comes out? Well, I think the motivation for this is kind of because for several reasons. So there are many interesting experiments. Here we have Design for SHIP, which is a beam dump experiment being built at CERN in the near future, and also EDMX, which is an axion detection experiment. Okay, we'll hopefully be built at CERN. the impression I get is that it's reasonably likely to happen, I hope. Maybe not. Okay, perhaps not. So what can theory contribute to this? Well, one thing it can do is highlight particularly interesting regions of parameter space to look for. If there are, as I said, there's no sort of canonical place to look, but if we can highlight particular points that have nice features or are beneficial or are particularly well motivated, this is clearly valuable. Secondly, it's important to determine existing limits from, for example, astrophysical systems. We need to understand what the limits already are so that we can understand what experiments are seeing or what experiments are probing. And we also want to understand the physics implications of new searches. So say some experiment constrains, some coupling as a function of mass, then is this constraining, for example, all axion models in a particular range, or is it only constraining some, et cetera, et cetera. And more positively, in the case of some anomaly or some discovery, we need theory to understand what the implications of this are and what it means for our UV model. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about a few things. First of all, the QCD axion, particularly its couplings, its role as dark matter, its cosmology. Then I'll talk a bit more generally about axion-like particles and some interesting features they can have if they are the dark matter. And finally, I'll say a bit about hidden sector photons and understanding the limits from supernovae. So hopefully, as I go through these topics, the things I showed on the previous slide will there'll be some connection, and I'll try to see how these things can work in practice. Okay, so first of all, the QCD axion. For me, this is probably one of the best motivated examples of beyond the standard model physics. The standard model has a strong CP problem. We're perfectly entitled to write down this operator in a Lagrangian, despite being a total derivative, in combination with the overall phase of the quark mass matrix, has physically relevant effects. It's CP violating, so in particular, it leads to neutron electron electric dipole moments, and these have been very well constrained by experiments. So the constraint on the overall combination theta is that it has to be tiny. That this is a problem is made sharper by the fact that the other phases in the Yukawa matrix are all order one, and this term also receives non-decoupling contributions from any new physics that violates CP and is at any scale. And even if you want to do anthropics, you can't do this in a viable way. So if theta is large, then nuclear physics is totally changed, and the universe would look very different. But by the time you make theta smaller than like 0.01, it has basically no effects on large-scale physics. So together, this really begs for a dynamical explanation. I think the most compelling of these is the QCD axion. So we start with the standard model, and we introduce a new field A, the axion with a shift symmetry, which is broken by a coupling to QCD. So here G is the QCD field strength as usual. And it also comes along with some scale FA, which is dimensionful and is typically high in viable models. Now as we run down in energy, QCD runs into strong coupling, and this leads to the axion getting a potential, and in particular this leads to it getting a VEV that removes theta, and also leads to an axion mass of this order. A nice bonus is that the axion can be dark matter in a large part of parameter space, and in some sense, at least axion candidates are common in string theories. The actual question of whether the axions survive down to the low energy theory and stay light, and also what their expected decay constants are, is a bit tricky and compactification dependent, but at least there are fields there that are candidate axions. Okay, having proposed the axion, of course you'd like to discover it. Since it has small couplings, discovery is hard, but there's been various interesting ideas to get around this. One particular thing you can do is use resonance effects, and a nice feature of this is that because you're using resonance, if we do detect an axion this way, we get a very precise determination of its mass. So delta M over M could be measured to like order 10 to the minus 6. This is just because it's limited by the axion velocity in the galaxy, which has V over C of like 10 to the minus 3. And depending on the experiment, we could also measure the axion's other couplings to high precision as well, in particular its couplings to photons. So the question we try to address in the paper is, can we exploit such a high precision experiment by reaching similarly high precision on the theory side? And could we do things like infer the UV completion of the axion and its cosmology? Okay, so just to set my notation, here's the UV Lagrangian. So we have the axion kinetic term, its coupling to GGU tilde, which I used to define the scale FA. And typically axion models also have some UV coupling to photons. This is here with a coefficient GA gamma gamma. And finally, they can have a shift symmetry preserving coupling to an axial current made out of the standard model quarks. And here, okay, one feature that maybe is slightly important later on is that the coupling to photons is proportional to a ratio of smallish integers in most theories. So it comes from a ratio of anomaly coefficients. So you expect it to be sort of a fraction of small integers. Okay, I can shift the shift symmetry breaking term away from the coupling to GGU tilde into a coupling to the quarks. So I just perform a chiral rotation on the first generation quarks. This form where A is the axion, so it's an axion dependent rotation. And this turns the Lagrangian into this form. So the GGU tilde coupling has disappeared. The coupling to photons has been modified, but is still the same form. This remains, and now the axion only couples via the quark mass matrix. So here, MA is the usual quark mass matrix for the up and down quark, but now it's modified by this axion part. Okay, and this contains all of the non-derivative couplings of the axion. And the technical feature is that the coupling to the axial current is only multiplicatively renormalized. So to get the low energy properties of the axion, we have to go below the QCD confinement scale. And at this point, the effective theory is chiral perturbation theory. So in principle, this, although at first sight, this seems like it might be a hard problem. All the QCD axion properties are coming from strong couplings, so maybe it's not so easy to work out what they are without direct measurements. But luckily, because FA is so large, the axion just acts as an external source in our chiral perturbation theory. So all its coupling is via this quark mass matrix. Or all the shift symmetry breaking coupling is via the quark mass matrix. And then the remainder is just via this axial current, which is easy to deal with. In particular, working out low energy correlators of external sources is exactly what chiral perturbation theory was invented for. This is why it exists. So chiral perturbation theory provides a consistent expansion for these things, order by order in momentum. At leading order, the p squared part is this. So b naught is a constant, f pi is pi under k constant. Big pi is the matrix of the pions, and u is the exponentiated version as usual. And here ma is the quark mass matrix modified with the axion couplings.
And here the transition from previous slide, the risk one requires the mass of beta prime to be taken to infinity.
This is true.
It's not identical.
This is true. We rely on this. Doesn't mess up the actual numerical. This assumption is safe. And I've been free to shift the axion into the first two generations, which is useful because two-flavor chiral perturbation theory converges a bit better than the three-flavor. You have a bit more of a mass gap between the things you included and the things you're not including. So having written this down, we can immediately work out the axion potential. You just do a few lines of algebra and you get out this expression. The slightly unusual square root form is because when theta is non-zero, the neutral pion gets a VeV and leads to this form. So here I've plotted it in the blue curve against as a function of the axion over FA. And the dashed orange curve is just the usual cosine potential. And these things, it's not a cosine. That's the only point I want to make here. For most pheno, this is not too crucial. It can matter a bit for the dark matter. And also there's a kind of, it's somewhat interesting because a pure instanton prediction would be a cosine or in the small coupling limit. But we know, chiral perturbation theory allows us to just write it down and it's not a cosine. And you can also immediately write down the axion mass. This has been known for a long time. And pretty much all of this was already done in the past by first Witten and later other people. So now we've got the leading order expression for the axion mass. We want to go to the next leading order. This will allow us to work out this to some high precision, or at least understand what precision we know this is at. So luckily, with chiral perturbation theory, this is easy. We can just compute the next leading order mass. So you get,
where does the mass of beta enter?
Mass of beta. This is already included in the chiral perturbation theory. There's no.
Because once you go to the higher order, the axion can mix with the eta and so on, and that's higher order.
There's no.
That's how non-zero mass it is in the first place. That the effect of eta is removed by the breaking of U1. So once you start computing to a higher order, to m q squared, the mass of eta should enter explicitly. I don't know if it enters in any of this coupling. If it doesn't, then it's not right.
It should be included in the higher. It's included in the higher order coefficients when we fit this with. Yeah, you fit the higher order coefficients with known data,
this,
and it will be.
Or?
But it can't be directly mass effect theory, because here it's a conventional character correlation.
Oh, well, there has to be, what I'm saying, that among the MQ squared corrections, there is a term that is M pi squared over M eta squared. Because I have a control. If I take the mass of eta to be small,
right,
the answer is zeros out completely for the whole mass.
No, that's fine, but eta is still some, you need something from this point.
But he calculates the corrections in terms of the second order in the fourth mass, right? And in those terms, the mass of eta should end up 100% with an eta.
No, but it's not the parameter in this.
Yeah.
So mass of eta is just to say, oh, actually hidden in one of the states in my mass of eta, but one may
I don't think that's just
a parameter of the theory, right? In substance, it's on the order of QCD scale.
Yeah, but it's a function of four masses and number of QCD, right? So if you don't care about it, you can, okay, you just ignore it.
No, but he cares, because he calculates the corrections in higher order, so that's why I'm asking how you treat the eta.
So I think the answer is that the eta mass appears in all of these high order things, but you fit these with observations. So the observations know about the mass of the eta. And this.
Your starting point is not correct, because in your starting point, you dropped out the eta contribution, right?
No,
but the eta is in.
You match all the energy theory, and the energy theory knows about the eta, right? Knows about all the QCD crap, but.
It's just like knowing the general Lagrangian for pines, and Peter is just.
But it depends to what accuracy, right? When you do it to MQ in the first power, then the previous formula was all.
But
right.
The axion. Okay, the axion is no different to pions in this sense, right? I can compute correlators of pions to higher order and higher order without having to explicitly put in
these. No, it's different from pions in the sense that if I take eta mass to the mass of the pion, the axion mass should vanish, right?
If eta was an effective theory, we need to worry about that. It's not an effective theory, and we can match
it. It is when you start calculating to the higher order and
why. Because I can just write effective theory like below 200 MeV.
I want to know which of these coefficients knows about the mass of the eta.
All of them.
All of them.
Yeah, that's the.
Because that's a crucial part, because your axiom mixes within.
Yeah, yeah, this is for sure. I mean, for sure, the physics of the eta is hidden within this stuff.
Right.
It's just not a sort of one parameter that you adjust, it comes into everything.
A little bit unsatisfying, but
okay. Okay, maybe we can. So you compute the higher order part within chiral perturbation theory, and you get out this result. So we have the leading order piece, and then a correction from the higher chiral coefficients.
So this is a loop, so there's a three levels?
So this is one loop, but it turns out that this order, all the logs disappear. So
the eta contribution is a three level, right? Because the axion can mix with an eta directly and go back.
No, but there's no eta in this theory, right?
But it's an effect of exactly the same order in the quark mass.
But integrated all physics about 200 MeV. There is no eta there. The effect is
but he has expansion parameter. It's MQ over lambda QCD. And he calculates the next term in the MQ over lambda QCD, right?
Yeah.
So, therefore, you have to put that contribution in.
No.
Absolutely, you have to.
So at tree level, this is the axiom mass, right?
No, that's why I'm saying that's a tree level effect. It's not a loop.
No, you can't do.
You can do one loop. What I'm saying is a tree-level effect.
No, but it's already integrated out. It's already encoded in these coefficients which you get. So that effect is
a loop.
No, you do loop characters in the effective field.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, no. Don't see the problem with that.
Yeah, okay. The tree-level axiom mass knows about the eta and chiral perturbation theory. Yes, this correct.
So there is roughly, if you like, if you rewrite it, it will be always like 1 over m pi squared minus 1 over m eta squared, right? Or something like that. So when you take m eta to infinity, that the whole thing drops out. And
Okay, I think I disagree, but we can, yeah.
No. If you take the mass of eta to the mass of the pi, then
no, for sure.
Is restored the
yeah, yeah, but then you need, then you put your eta in your effective field theory, and it. If you're, the eta, well, you're working, I'm working in an effective field theory with everything except the pi.
If the eta was lighter, then the cutoff would be lower.
That is correct. Yes. And what I'm saying is a trivial effect of the epsilon mixing with an eta, which is of course irrelevant for this formula because it will be higher order in the chiral perturbation theory. But when you calculate the chiral
there's no eta in the effective field theory, so there's no mixing in the effective field theory at all. I think that's the point, right?
If you are at large length, then you need to keep eta because it's light, but it's n equals 3, so you can, if it's heavy, you can just integrate out, because we know it's heavy, so...
Well, that's integrating out contains q squared effect.
Yeah, but this is all then captured in these parameters of effective theory.
Not in this formula, but in the next formula, maybe.
Yeah, this is...
But then what I'm trying to say, it's not a loop. It's a tree level.
It's
right?
A loop within the chiral perturbation theory, or it's higher order with it. So it's a combination of a loop from the p squared piece and a tree level from the p to the 4 piece. And this is how the chiral expansion goes.
In practice, how will this affect...
No practice here.
Right. He's giving a scenario so we can more ways to look experiment.
Yes.
So how is this argument going to affect the...
Ah, okay, so hopefully this will become clear in, say, 4 slides time. Okay, so this is, I claim the axion mass to one loop. We can determine the chiral coefficients within our effective field theory by looking at, for example, decays of pions, by looking at other effects. You can also get these things from the lattice, in which case, you know, the computation of them is completely transparent. You just put QCD on in a lattice, you work it out, and it comes out. So the other ingredient we need is the ratio of the up and down quark masses. So for a long time, this was not known particularly precisely, but now lattice determinations are getting better, and it's known accurately. So, putting this all together, we get the axion mass to percent level precision as a function of this decay constant. Okay, I'll skip the potential, but we can do the same game with the axion coupling to photons. So we get we have the UV piece, which is E over N, as before. Then we have a piece which comes as mixing with the pion. So this is effectively tree level, if you like. And this is an irreducible QCD part. So no matter what your axion model is, the fact that it couples to QCD means that it will also... it will couple to the photon this way. Then we compute loops as before. So we have some new chiral coefficients here, and we also have some new loop diagrams. Compared to the chiral coefficients that were important for the mass, these are a bit harder to determine, but okay, so we have large relative errors on them, but their absolute value is still pretty small. Okay, now to answer your question, the reason that we care about this is that we can put in all our ingredients. Now we get the axion coupling to photons as a function of E over N, and then as some numerical factor, which is coming from QCD. This enables us to draw a graph where we have the axion coupling to photons against the axion mass, and we can draw this for different values of E over N. So for different UV axion models, we'd have different lines in this plane. And we also...
In the leading order, 194, what is it?
So the leading order part was like 195 or something. So before we did this computation, it could have... Yeah, so this is exactly the point. Before we did the computation, it was consistent that E over N equals 2 models could have no coupling to photons, whereas now we know that there's a lower bound on the coupling to photons as a function of the axion mass. So if some experiment comes back and gives us an exclusion in this plane that looks something like this, we can say for sure that axions with masses between these values is ruled out. There's no...
It's a small integer ratio.
For small integer ratios, it's hard to imagine how you could get something that looked like 192 over 100.
But
we're going to
have
E over N, isn't it? So E over N is a ratio of anomaly coefficients in the UV theory, so the ratio of the anomaly with U1. Photon. Some rational number with smallish integer curve, not numerator and denominator. Yeah, you don't expect it to be something crazy. So typically it's 0, 8 over 3, 2, this sort of thing. Okay, we do this. Can do the same game with couplings to nucleons. Again, we set up an effective field theory where you just have the nucleons and the axion, and then you compute things. And we can get out the coefficients for example, the KSPZ axion, which is a particular implementation of it, or the DSPZ axion, These are known to sort of order like 10% accuracy at the moment, and this one is still compatible with zero, so there could be no coupling to neutrons in this model.
So is there a simple way to see why CN is so much smaller than
CN? It's accidental, yeah. Some of different things and this thing. Okay, so that's the zero temperature properties. We also care about the finite temperature properties of the axion. So in principle, as the temperature increases, QCD gets weaker, the axion mass should get smaller, and eventually we should be able to get finite temperature properties to high precision because of this. So QCD becomes perturbative and can compute everything. The reason this matters is because it's important for the axion relic abundance. If you want the axion to be dark matter, then you need to know these things. Okay, so at very low temperatures, we can compute the temperature dependence within chiral perturbation theory. If you remember the formula for the mass, then the one loop correction had the form of m pi squared, f pi squared times stuff that was local. And finite temperature is roughly equivalent to compactifying the time dimension. So it will only affect our observables via non-local effects. In particular, this means that within chiral perturbation theory, the axial mass at finite temperature is set just by the temperature dependence of the pion mass and its decay constant. And we can just compute this in terms of one of these integrals that is well known in field theory. However, unfortunately, this computation is not very accurate. So it doesn't include the effects of heavy states which are suppressed, which have effects suppressed by e to the m over t. So in the limit that t goes to zero, these heavy states don't have any finite temperature effect, and all of their zero temperature effects are included within our chiral Lagrangian. But at finite temperature, they do have effects. And it turns out that for t around the critical temperature, the ratio m over t is not particularly big. And also, there are many new states. So this means that chiral perturbation theory basically breaks down as soon as it predicts a deviation away from the zero temperature mass. At very high temperature, there's an old calculation by Gross, Pizarki, and Yaffa for the axion mass as a function, in terms of an integration over instantons. So we have here d rho, which is the size of the instantons, n of rho is the zero temperature prediction for the instanton density, and then the instantons are cut off, large instantons are cut off effectively by screening. So the gluon, roughly speaking, gets a thermal mass. And this means that instantons with size much bigger than the inverse of this thermal mass don't contribute. And in particular, the leading order prediction for the cutoff is in terms of the Debye mass, which is this expression. So this is nice, and this is what people used for many years. But unfortunately, finite temperature QCD does not converge well. So example for this is the Debye mass itself, which is, remember, what was cutting off the instantons. So it has a leading order piece that goes as GT. But then it has a next leading order piece, which is suppressed only by one factor of G, which is computable. And then it also has a completely uncomputable part coming from soft magnetic physics, which is, again, suppressed only by one factor of G relative to our leading order piece. And for scales around 1 GeV, which are the sort of temperatures we care about for the QCD axion, G is really not small enough for this expansion to make sense. In particular, here's a plot of the Debye mass divided by the temperature as a function of the temperature. These are lattice data, and this is the analytic computation for different renormalization scales. And you can see that even as you get up towards, say, 800 MeV, you're just nowhere close to the actual the lattice value. And this enters exponentially in our computation of the axion mass. So it's really not good. Just to emphasize that finite temperature QCD is really not converging well further, this is a plot of the pressure against the temperature. Sure. So the g squared piece is here, g cubed is here, g to the 4 is here, but then g5 is back down here. So it's really jumping everywhere. So to get the axiom mass, okay, we can't use instantons, but luckily we've got another tool, which is Lattice. This is finite temperature. Lattice QCD is in some ways hard, and it's hard to push to temperatures that are high above, much higher than the, say, the QCD confinement scale. But there's been a lot of progress in this direction recently. And once you have the, well, once you have some lattice expressions, you can extract the axial mass at finite temperature. There's a bit of controversy or a bit of uncertainty at the moment in terms of what the axial mass actually is. So one group, based mostly in Rome and places like this, has this prediction for the axial mass. So the dots are the data points. This is the instanton approximation, and this is the chiral perturbation theory prediction, which you shouldn't trust effectively anywhere. So this is showing a large deviation from the instanton prediction. On the other hand, there's been some more recent work, which is again by another reliable, or reasonably reliable, lattice group, which shows that it's much closer to the instanton prediction. So this is plotting the gradient of the axial mass grade with temperature.
Sorry, I don't understand the cross plot, because it looks like here instanton, it was kind of normalized that instanton matches at low temperature, but when one expects another way around, they should kind of work in quick coupling with high temperature. So,
I think, yeah, it turns out that the lowish temperatures actually are more precise, just because you get less of these problems with scanning the whole range of topological sectors of your theory. So it turns out that these points are the ones that are best determined.
With the instanton calculation, yep, is it normalized to hit the correct mass at zero, or does that come out anyway?
The instanton mass is normalized here to be hit the right one at zero. Yeah.
So I think that's just normalized, it's just put in there by hand.
Well, which is doesn't sound like.
No,
I know, so the only thing you should look at is the gradient. Right. Yeah. The gradient is the only thing. That...
The gradient is completely wrong everywhere, it's not just the normalization.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly. Ah, no, so the error bars in the lattice are genuine error bars, well, up to the usual lattice problems. And they do reproduce the chiral perturbation theory prediction at low temperatures automatically. The instanton one is normalized, so its failing is really a failing on its shape rather than a failing on its normalization. Even if you changed its normalization, it wouldn't.
I mean, actually, is there a prediction at high temperatures? Presumably there is an absolute normalization of the instanton perturbation at high temperatures.
Right? Yes, but you don't trust it down to...
Sure, but if we change this curve so it matched on to the correct normalization at high temperatures, where would it lie? The dilution instanton gas approximation one.
So... Okay, in this case it would be a long way off. But again, the fact that it's a long way off is just kind of a statement that it's not working well.
And so how do you compare this to plots?
So this one is just the gradient directly, so it removes this.
So the thing from the first plot is basically that instanton gas doesn't work at this temperature.
Yep, exactly.
And the second plot now shows what?
So this is the prediction for the gradient, which is like -7 or something. And the lattice measurement of the gradient of the axial mass squared with temperature. And they appear to match pretty well already around here.
So red line is what? Is the instanton?
Red line is the instanton prediction, and this is the lattice data. So certainly here it looks good, even down here, which is where these people were finding a large deviation in the shape. It seems to look good as well.
So
So if you translated this and normalized it somehow correctly, it would look more like it would look like this prediction here from the instantons.
It would look like the yellow kind
of. This one would look like.
So is it the lattice data is different, or that the? It's the lattice data.
Different. Yeah, the lattice data is really different. These two things are disagreeing on something physical. That's the source of the uncertainty at the moment.
And then where
is
So there's some, as always with lattice, there's some question about who exactly has done the extrapolation to zero lattice space incorrectly and all of these concerns. But in principle, this is something which should be resolved just with more lattice work. Okay, and one thing which maybe doesn't matter so much for Pheno but might be interesting to look at in the future is if you can take these lattice configurations and actually identify which regions are contributing to the topological charge and which of the, and then explicitly look at them and see whether these gauge configurations look like instantons. It's probably hard, but it might even be possible to measure the size of these instanton-like configurations if they exist. And then you could compare with the perturbative prediction. And there's been some sort of very preliminary work here done in the past. Okay, so the reason this matters is for axion dark matter. So in the early universe, the axion evolves according to this equation. H is the Hubble parameter, and it has a potential. At high temperatures, the axion field is fixed. So it's fixed to a constant value over the observable universe if PQ symmetry is broken before inflation. But if PQ symmetry is broken after inflation, it's random over the observable universe. Then the temperature drops, the axion mass becomes larger, the Hubble parameter becomes smaller, and eventually the axion starts oscillating. Then it reaches a solution where it reaches a co-moving number density and acts as cold dark matter. Okay, so now I've plotted all of the parameter space pretty much on one picture. So here is the axion decay constant, here's the scale of inflation, and these are experimental constraints. So these things should be read as applying to all Hubble's, scales of inflation for a particular decay constant. So this one, for example, Casper is sensitive to everything along here. So over to the left of this line is the region where PQ symmetry is broken before inflation. This part of the plot is ruled out by isocurvature, and over here you can get the correct dark matter relic abundance by choosing theta naught and r part of the universe correctly. Then over here we have PQ symmetry broken after inflation, in which case you don't have the freedom to pick the initial misalignment angle, and to get the correct dark matter relic abundance, you have to sit somewhere around here. And I've plotted this for both the lattice temperature dependencies of the axion mass and the instanton prediction. Well, by lattice, I mean the older lattice, the one that was deviating from the instanton prediction. And you can see that this makes a pretty significant difference to the way this looks. So, for example, roughly one order of magnitude here. And if you're building some experiment which is probing this part of parameter space, then this is going to matter.
Mm-hmm. The cosmology favored mass is about 10 to minus 20 electron volts. The reason is that you have to calculate the structure problem. Determine the mass of power spectrum. This is your favorite. Mass is much less than 100 electron volts.
You're saying that
there's a lot of papers on this.
If you want it to be fuzzy dark matter effect structure.
Yeah, if you don't want it to just act as cold dark matter, you have to be in different parts of parameter space. But for my purposes, I'm assuming that cold dark matter is compatible with the observations. Maybe this is. I think certainly, for sure, cold dark matter is not ruled out.
This is not worse. So these are axioms. You have to redo the cosmology calculation. The favored mass is much smaller than that.
For sure, I do not think there's consensus. I think there's not consensus that these masses are incompatible with observation.
But the problem is that we're going all the way from 10 to the minus 8 electron volts, 10 to the minus 22. How do you know where to look? You're not going to do experiments.
Well, for example, in some sense, you have to look everywhere. But in the case that PQ symmetry is broken after inflation, you have particular predictions for where you should lie for the correct dark matter relic abundance. And this gives you a particular axion mass to look at. So, for example, it would make good sense once this confusion between the temperature dependencies is resolved, it will make good sense to look at, for example, this, whichever point it ends up here. Because for all theories over to this side of of the line, you have to live there.
You have white hole super radius. This is highly spectacular.
Yes, that's why. That is why it's a dashed line. That's why it's a dashed line.
Very spectacular.
Maybe the line. Okay. Maybe you would prefer the line is more dashed, but it's.
Let's keep to what we know. What we think we know.
I guess that FA equals an inflationary parameter line could be loosened a little bit if you consider that repeating happening as
something. Oh, yeah, for sure. This is also in the brackets. Yeah. This is a worthwhile point to make. But, yeah.
And so the production uncertainty on this domain wall or this stuff, so is it?
This is arrow here. So this is work in progress, but it's a hard problem. We hope that maybe we could at least, in the future, we'll be able to at least pin down how big the uncertainties are, because at the moment you don't even know how big the uncertainties are, let alone the true value. So this would be, yeah. And of course, this will matter for experiments, whether you know whether you should be probing from here to here. Okay, I think in the interest of time, I'll skip the axion particles and go straight to hidden sector photons. Okay, if you prefer. Okay, I'm fine. Okay, so these, the audience has voted. Okay, so these are similar to the QCD axion, and in the sense they have a shift symmetry, but instead of the QCD axion, which gets mass from QCD, this now gets mass from some hidden sector or from some non-perturbative effects at a high scale. Again, just like the QCD axion, they can be dark matter. And there's, again, two scenarios. PQ symmetry might be broken before inflation, in which case you just have a flat axion density in the observable universe. Or it might be broken after inflation, in which case it's initially random. Now, okay, again, in the second case, which I'll focus on, which is where it's broken after inflation, you can make a sharp prediction for the ALP relic abundance as a function of its mass, just because there's no freedom to adjust anything, assuming the standard cosmology at least. And you can make a plot that looks like this. So here we have the axion mass parameterized in terms of some strong coupling scale, maybe a hidden sector strong coupling scale, and some parameter epsilon. This just takes into account that, for example, the QCD axion mass depends on the up and down quark masses. And we also give the axion mass some temperature dependence. And motivated by the usual strong coupling stuff, I assume this is a power law. Then, in order to get the correct relic abundance, we can plot the axion mass against its decay constant for different parameterizations of the temperature dependence. So, for example, if you have no temperature dependence, which is what you expect if you have the axion mass coming from instantons at high scale, for example, string instantons or something like this, then the correct relic abundance demands that you lie on this line of FA against MA. And as you change the temperature dependence in epsilon, you move down to here. And this one pretty much saturates the furthest you can push the parameter space. So for a given axion mass, you know, or given axion like particle mass, you know which FA you need. And the QCD axion, with its uncertainty from the temperature dependence and from strings and domain walls, is roughly in this region. Then at higher values of FA, assuming a standard cosmology, you can't have PQ symmetry broken after inflation, and just because you would have observed primordial gravitational waves already. So these lines get cut off here. Now, as a result of the axion field being random initially, it's not just like the usual, or it's not like the typical scenarios where the dark matter is constant over the observable universe, and instead it has density fluctuations. So we start off, what we do is we begin long before the axion mass has turned on, when the axion is massless and just sits at constant values pretty much. And then we numerically evolve the field forwards through the time in which the axion mass turns on and see what happens, see where the axion density lives. This is a plot of the axion energy density normalized to 1 for some spatial slice. So here the normalization is, the spatial axes are normalized so that 1 corresponds to the Hubble scale when the axion mass turns on. And in particular, you can see that the fact that the axial mass was initially random leads to regions where there are overdensities in the, well, that once the axial mass is turned on, these things turn on, lead to overdensities in the dark matter spatial distribution. But there's also smoothing, so that you get about one of these per Hubble patch at the time when the axial mass turns. And the overdensities roughly have a size of about a factor 6. Okay, you evolve further on in time, and then you reach matter radiation equality. At this point, the overdensities are known to collapse, so this has been studied before, both analytically and numerically with n-body simulations. And you get even a prediction analytically, which works pretty well numerically, that the eventual density of these collapsed overdense objects should be about 140 times phi to the 4, roughly, where phi is the relative overdensity before matter radiation equality, which was about 6 for our model. And here rho c is the background axion density, background dark matter density at these times. So this is, again, a plot of a spatial slice after matter radiation equality, which some people did, it's about 10 years ago now. And you can see that you have these, well, the light regions are regions of overdensities, and this is on a log scale, so these things really are quite a lot more dense than the surrounding dark matter.
Just go back to the previous slide.
Yep.
So that was that taking into account the cell interactions?
Yes.
Okay. And that's assuming a cosine potential?
This is assuming cosine potential. This plot does, but you can check with other periodic potentials
and
nothing really changes. Maybe you make this 6 something different, but not dramatically different.
So in other linguistic connection scenarios, it's really just that you have an extended period of matter dominating.
Yep.
Is that what's going to happen?
No, so this case, it's literally just the initial fluctuations in the axion field turn into mini clusters. There's no... Yeah.
You have much stronger short-wave perturbations in the dark matter.
Okay, so you get out some mass for these mini clusters, which you can predict as a function of the scale at which the axion begins oscillating. And they have some radius, which is typically somewhere in the, well, of the size of solar systems, maybe a bit smaller, maybe a bit larger, but there or thereabouts.
So those things survive ahead of disruptions and dependent?
This is a big question and also future work. So they survive. There's good reason to think that at least the core of them survives. You expect that maybe some will be disrupted, but probably, well, almost certainly not all of them, and probably a significant number survive. People say things like half surviving, or half of the mass surviving.
None
of the arguments are hugely compelling. I agree that the late time evolution is completely uncertain, but at least they're there to begin with, and there's the potential that they could do things in the future. I think it's going to be hard to say anything really believable about the late time evolution without.
What can you say about the density of axions in this group? You have to do experiments to find them in labs.
Yeah. So this...
I don't know if it's very under-dense, then we'll never see.
So in this case, you reduce the background density of axions by a factor of... Well, the exact factor is unknown for the reasons we were saying, but probably by a factor of, like, maybe a half. So you...
How likely is the gulf one that is once?
Sorry? Unlikely. Yeah. Probably ill. Yeah. Unlikely.
This is a critical question,
right? Oh, yeah, for sure. So, in order to.
Millions of dollars are spent. If you can figure out that the density is small here and wasting the money.
Billions are not spent.
Millions?
They're not spent. Billions are not spent.
Millions. I didn't say I corrected myself.
I think if billions were spent, we would cover the whole parameter range. So it will reduce the background dark matter density maybe by a factor of a half or something, but it's not going to completely destroy it, just because there's still this background, and you're looking at things like tidal disruption adding to the background and removing from these dense objects.
And it's already uncertain to that factor or more anyway.
How reliable is that statement?
The statement that it's uncertain is very reliable.
The factor of a half,
This is order of magnitude.
This is rather critical.
I agree, but it's hard to address. I would be very surprised, in the sense that it's going to be easier to remove axions from these objects and add them to the background than it is to accrete from the background onto these objects. So somehow this factor of half is more like the upper bound on how many might be trapped. Okay, and then we can take we can actually make a prediction for what the masses of these mini clusters should be. So we just take our plot from before, and then we can evolve it forward, and here we get the mini cluster mass as a function of compared to a solar mass, as a function of the axion mass. And these lines are the same different temperature dependencies I showed before. And in particular, they cut off at the points where the FA required in order to get the correct dark matter density is above 10 to the 14, in which case the scenario is not viable. So this means that, say, you want to have a mini cluster which is very heavy. For example, you might think that it could combine to form, could do interesting things or be detectable in this range. This means that you can only have a very small range of axion masses, and these axion masses have to be pretty light. So the QCD axion, which is, of course, a particularly well-motivated case, sits down here and typically forms mini clusters which are about 10 to the minus 12 of a solar mass. And you can also.
Just for me to understand, this is a gravity supported structure?
These are gravity supported, yeah.
So in the halo, they would be disrupted and present some streams? Like those clusters are disrupted by.
Yeah, sure. This is to be expected. This is expected, but it's hard to say precisely what will happen. It would be great to make some sharp prediction for what will happen, but I don't know how to, and it's not clear. It's not clear how to make progress with this in a reliable way. Of course, you can do unreliable things, but to really say something accurate.
Any gravitational bound system passing by massive objects will be
a
stream.
Right? Oh, for sure, but in terms of actual quantitative predictions, for what this means.
You probably can do that. I mean, you can look at tidal stripping from cluster. People, astrophysicists do have things, but this should look pretty much like cold dark matter at the scales.
I think.
I mean, you can do the limit, this wooden paper last week.
Sure.
Did the limit where you had basically one wave length or so in these things, and then tidal stripping apparently looks like tunneling out for reasons that I'm unclear on. So in the middle, there's.
You could do a pretty prosaic estimate by just considering how often it passes near massive bodies and just figuring out how often it crosses the Roche limit. And for that, you just need to know the density of these guys. But maybe we can.
Maybe you can do, yeah. Maybe at least some coarse grained estimates are possible. So given that these things at least exist at early times and they potentially survive to late times, it'll be interesting to have some observational signatures. It turns out that without any further collapse, the density of these things is too low for, galactic lensing to place constraints on them. So this in particular means that macho constraints don't apply. As I say, potentially about half of the dark matter could be in these mini clusters. And in the future, these things might be observable in microlensing. So this could probe the interesting mass range of somewhere between some fraction of the solar mass. And an interesting feature of this is.
What central density is that correspond to?
I forget the exact number, but pretty low. Compared to the background high, compared to other densities. And one feature of these potential microlensing signatures is that it could look very different to a typical point source. So the fact that these things are reasonably diffuse and have fairly large radius could mean that the microlensing signatures are very, well, very distinguishable from a point-like object. So that's about time, so I'm not sure. Okay, in this case, I'll show one plot for the hidden sector photons, just to prove that it exists. So these are limits on hidden sector photons coming from supernova as a function of their coupling and their mass. The dashed black line is the kinetic theory prediction, and the non-dashed lines are the prediction when thermal field theory is done properly. So you get contributions from longitudinal emission of hidden sector photons, contributions from resonance emission of longitudinal photons or transverse photons, and emission of continuum transverse photons. And even the parametric form can change. Okay, so to summarize, I think new light particles are well motivated by pheno and by UV physics, and it's useful and interesting to explore their physics. In particular, the QCD axion is a very well motivated candidate. Its zero temperature properties are well known, and its finite temperature and cosmology are still pretty uncertain. But given future work, this should become resolvable. Axion-like particles are also interesting and can have interesting or unusual dark matter distributions. And finally, hidden sector photons are another viable candidate. But in order to understand the existing constraints, it's important to take into account things like thermal effects when you look at supernova and stellar cooling and these sort of things. Okay, so thank you.
Any other questions? One quick provocative question. I've been searching for axions for 20 years. Why don't we see them?
This is a fair point. Okay, maybe from a Lorentzian perspective, the original axion models at the weak scale were perfectly good and were quickly ruled out. If you look at the parameter space, so I have so this is the plot of the existing constraints, which are colored in the future experiments against the decay constant. So you can see that a bit of the parameter space has been covered, but there's still large chunks. You're certainly not getting to the stage of like having to really fine tune into particular parts of parameter space. There's still big classes that are viable.
So with the mini clusters and stuff, at least in the QCD axion case, you expect all the ways about strings and domain walls and stuff to that story.
Yep.
To some degree. For other mass dependencies of the for other temperature dependencies of the axion mass, does that help? How do you expect to change the string domain wall story? Or
I think the temperature dependence will affect the end result, but the pheno will not be, or the Brill scale qualitative properties will not be so different.
So for all of those things, there is significant
For sure.
Uncertainty from the fact that you do expect some funny limits.
Yeah, for sure. This is only true.
Any other questions?
Okay. Well, if not, then let's thank her again.